Yo, people, Anna David with After Party Pod. After Party Pod is a part of After Party Magazine, a website determined to change the face and get rid of the stigma around addiction and recovery. Now, After Party is a part of RehabReviews.com, the world's largest resource for treatment centers across the globe. You can go there to see if your rehab stay could be free. Go to RehabReviews.com/benefits-check. What else can you do there, you may ask? You can get a Recover Girl t-shirt. Just go to rehabreviews.com/after-party/shop. Anyway, you'd know all of this if you were signed up for our newsletter. What are you doing? Go sign up, rehabreviews.com/newsletter-sign-up. Now here's the show.
Welcome to the After Party. It's time to change. You're just getting started. You can teach an old dog new ways, and not just on Saturday.
Hey, you guys. It's Anna David with After Party Pod, something you know because you just listened to that intro, that ad intro, whatever you want to call it. I have made a conscious decision to make these intros more professional sounding. I've been listening to other podcasts and really liking when people do that. So what am I listening to in particular? I've been listening to the Nerdist podcast with Chris Hardwick. You know, I originally started this podcast because I was such a fan of podcasts, and at some point I think I forgot that and I stopped listening, and I have somebody coming on the show. I'm going to New York this weekend and D.C. For that Unite to Face Addiction rally. It'll be long over by the time you hear this, but I'm sure it will be pretty spectacular. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, I'm sure I'll have written something on the site about it by then, and it's lots of other people will have too. But regardless, I'm interviewing somebody in New York for the podcast, somebody I've been very excited to get on, and I was thrilled he said yes, and I am not going to say his name because what if he bails and I have to then come back and feel humiliated, which I wouldn't, but I wouldn't feel happy about it. So that's happening. Now, what else did I want to tell you? Okay, I'm now a life coach. What do you think of that? Tell me the truth. I went and got certified to become a life coach. And originally I thought I'm doing this because this will be a great thing to have in my back pocket, as they say. You know, I went to UCLA a few years ago to get I dropped out, so that's part of why I can't say it. I think that there's some shame in that. Getting certified to become a drug and addiction counselor over there, and I was only doing it to sort of educate myself. I knew that I would never become a counselor, and so by the same logic, I thought, I will learn about life coaching, and I will learn what this is about, and it will inform what I'm doing. And possibly, I thought, I could do some workshops. I do think about that as I think about After Party expanding. I think about doing workshops where you're helping people to write and heal simultaneously. It's not about writing to get published, although that could certainly be part of it, but writing out their stories, whether they're addiction stories or any other stories, and getting comfortable with that. And I thought, I could incorporate life coaching into that. And then I was off on, we could be in Jamaica and we could be in Hawaii and we could be getting massages and drinking smoothies in between all of this. And it, you know, the brain goes where it will go. But anyway, after learning this process and how to do it, I have to say I'm kind of interested and excited about doing it. And I am not saying this. I am saying this. I'm not good at very much. What I'm good at, I'm very good at, but there's just so much I can't do in the world. And so take that, what I'm about to say, with that knowledge. That teacher said I had a gift. I do feel like this falls into this very specific skill set I have, which has to do with obsessively connecting to and remembering what anybody says having to do with emotions and remembering and connecting to almost nothing else. So I think I'm going to not only start doing this, but also start by doing this on the podcast. Yep. Live for you. And my first friend today said, not my first friend, but a friend who knows I did this came to me today and said, I really need help. Can we do this today? So I'm about to, I tried walking my mom through this over the phone, you know, doing life coaching on her, and that didn't work very well. But I think that this will. So I'm excited. The guest today is an old friend of mine, and she's lovely, and it's a really fun interview. Her name is Kristen McGinnis. She's an extremely talented writer, and if we could afford her, we'd have her writing for After Party. She is the best-selling author of the book 5150, The Magical Adventures of a Single Life. And that book was an LA Times bestseller and was optioned. And she is spectacular. She writes for a bunch of other places. And she's now doing ghostwriting, which she talks about. And her dad was this drug kingpin. It's a really good interview. So I hope you will enjoy it and enjoy her. So this is Kristen McGinnis.
I first started taking drugs by chewing blocks of hash.
Oh my God. I think my copy has like blood stains on it from shooting up while reading it.
Party animal. I hate to say that because that makes me sound Paris Hilton-y. I was on the, as right. I call it, the Autobahn to nowhere.
I'm very lucky because would you have wanted to have a celebrity junkie for a dad?
Yeah. We're going.
Oh, we're going.
We're going.
Okay.
I might even take off my shoes.
Good, feel free. I'm wearing a knee brace.
Yeah, why are you wearing that?
Because I'm attempting to lose baby weight and started running again and injured my knee. Not running. I injured it walking across the dining room. And so
the running thing is irrelevant.
No. Yeah, no, I just hurt it because I stepped into the dining room.
Did you hurt it from lack of sleep and baby brain?
No, I think I just heard it because I hurt myself frequently.
Do you? Are you accident prone?
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
Yeah, I'm one of those people that get like staph infections and weird things that nobody else gets.
No, well, a girl who works for me just got a staph infection and she tried to tell me about it and I was so repulsed that I made her stop.
I get the thing that nobody else has that the doctor's like, wow, I haven't really seen this in a long time.
Really?
I don't even know how that happened to you, honestly.
I'm like that with technology. Whenever I take it to the no one's ever had this before.
TechMD is like, we've just never seen this issue.
Yeah, Genius Bar is like, so strange. So I'm so glad you're here. This is both, you know, an episode and a catch up for us because we were going to have lunch.
In lieu of lunch. Yeah.
And I said, well, hey, we could skip the food and we could just talk.
Microphones.
And just with microphones, which apparently you love.
Yeah,
so there
I do.
You go.
Ever since I was a kid. Obsessed.
Really?
Yeah. I should have been a performer. Anything to hold a microphone is really a good time for me.
Don't you sort of in some ways feel like being a writer is being a performer or no?
It is. Yeah. I mean, I think to a certain extent, but I don't know. I don't really write that much anymore. I feel like, so I've lost that even medium for performance, but I also think that, I mean, for me, some of the funnest parts of being a writer was getting to go out and actually be in front of people with it.
Right.
You know,
right.
Well, sometimes I don't think I actually like to write. I just like the end product.
Well,
which is funny because I ghostwrite.
Right.
So
I don't even get the
joy.
End product.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. There's some famous quote by who I can't remember that's, I don't like writing. I like having written.
Yes. Yeah. No, that's me. Yeah.
Do you go through this thing? I know we're not talking about addiction, but yeah, it's fine. Do you go through the thing where you're writing and you're going, I'm not enjoying this. Why am I a writer? I thought I enjoyed this.
Yeah.
And you're beating yourself up for not enjoying it more.
That's why I don't write. I'm like,
really?
I just don't like it. And then I'm like, and then I sit around and I think, oh, I should be writing right now instead of watching America's Next Top Model season 22. But,
right.
But I'm
right.
like, why? Because I don't like writing and I like watching America's Next
but
Top Model season 22.
But you do like writing. You couldn't be as good at it as you are and not like it at all. Or could you?
I don't know. I don't know that I'm that. Maybe because I now wonder whether I'm actually that good at it. So then the two, you know, the two get into a nasty dance then. Yeah.
Do you think that, I used to do, when I guess, it just has been a while on air TV things, especially when you're in a little room by yourself. And so it's just maddening. I would finish and I'd go, oh my God, that was so awful. I was so awful. And then I'd go, well, wait a minute. They always ask me back. So maybe I'm not as awful at it as I think. Do you think, given your success as a writer, that possibly you, that theory that you might not be good at it is incorrect?
Yeah. You know, the funny thing is I write things for other people. And sometimes editors know that it's that I'm on board. Other times they don't. They just think that the person I'm writing for is that person. Yeah. And then they get this amazing feedback, like, this is one of the greatest pieces we've read. And I'm like, I can cuss, right? We're this
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm like, shit, man. Like, why aren't I, like, why aren't I putting my name on things? Like, that doesn't make sense. Like, if I'm that good, like, why am I doing, why am I staging this for somebody else's
but
success?
You get that feedback when you do write under your own name.
I do. I just write less and less now under my own
name.
Okay. Unless I'm writing random articles for sober websites.
Well, so, okay. So,
that's what my writing's limited to these days.
Hold on. You had a LA Times bestselling book. Let's be clear.
Yes.
And
5 years ago.
Oh God. Well, but isn't it just mostly how depressing the time passes?
Yeah.
More than like the not writing.
Yeah.
But okay. So 5150, it's called.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the subtitle?
The Magical Adventures of a Single Life.
And it was a book where you spent a year. Go on. You tell it.
Okay. I had 1 year of sobriety, which meant, if you follow the rules, you can date. And at that point, I was kind of following the rules. I did pretty good. You know, started off a little rough. And then after getting screwed over by enough boys within the first 6 weeks of sobriety, was like, okay, I'm going to do that, like, you know, mancation. And at a year's point, I decided I was going to basically go out on a date every week for a year. But it was the time when Britney Spears had that 5150. And so I thought,
the
5150 was out in the, like,
in the cultural landscape.
Yes.
The umbrella
and the shaved head.
Yeah.
So I was like, you know what would be really cute and brilliant would be to do 51 dates in 50 weeks and then use the 5150 title since it was about being sober and dating.
Absolutely.
So it was sort of like a sober in the city.
Yeah.
Set in L.A.
This is a girl who's done some marketing for this book.
This is a girl that tried to make a TV show. So,
well,
yeah.
I remember a fancy actress was attached.
Yeah.
Is she still?
No. We went out. We'll talk about this.
Yeah. This is
hence
fun, right?
Why I don't write anymore. End of summer. Yeah. Last year. We actually took it into networks to pitch, and about 2 weeks prior, one major network where we thought we were a for sure deal, our writer was actually from that network. They told us that they weren't doing any more shows on addiction, and our writer decided to pull the entire addiction and sobriety thread out of the book.
Oh my God.
So basically what you discover really quickly is if you have a person or character who behaves like an addict without actually having an addiction,
right,
they're a narcissistic sociopath. So and nobody likes a narcissistic sociopath unless they're Hannibal Lecter, which my character didn't have that level of charisma. So
it
very quickly like fell on its face, and that's what went out and pitched. Was this really immature, vapid girl doing absolutely inane things without the excuse of addiction.
Right.
Which just isn't attractive or really even interesting, I think. So it really, like, they went out and pitched it. They pitched it to three major cable, you know, online entertainment networks. And even though we had awesome people attached, we were no'd. And very quickly afterwards, everybody just sort of melted off the project.
Yeah.
Which is what happens.
Yeah. So. Who was the actress, or does it not matter anymore?
Alison Brie.
Who is, like, I just was reading, who's in a movie about addiction. Did you know that? That just came out?
Yes. She's a sex addict.
Sex addict, yes.
Yeah. And she was doing that movie at the time that we were pitching this.
Right.
And she's awesome. I actually, the reason she got on board was that I used to work with her mom.
I remember.
And like all good things, it was like personal. And
yeah.
I love her mom, and her mom loves me, and that's how I met Allie. And she was awesome, and she was great. And then our writer was actually a writer from Nurse Jackie. And he was awesome, and he's great. And unfortunately, you know, you listen to the one note that you probably shouldn't listen to, and
I
you
know.
Lose the story. And it's like, everybody has that tale of woe.
You know, yeah. So. I mean, with my memoir, I remember the people who were making Community they never bought it. You know, the new thing is they don't even option it. Yeah. They're just like, oh, you're so excited that we're interested that we
totally.
Just...
That's all we have to do.
Yeah. And so, of course, I was like, sign me up. And they brought in a writer who you know, in quotes, every single network wanted to work with. Mm-hmm. And she was lovely. And I just would sit in these meetings and she was like, she was like, well, instead of you being this, you're going to be this. The best friend is going to... So just like changes for the sake of changes.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I didn't really... And then they made me... I went on all the pitches. I had said to them, please, and this is what I say with every... if there's ever interest in a book, take it, go sell it. I don't care what you do with it. I don't care who you sell to. Come back and let me know when the check's coming. I don't care. And instead they said, you know, we think you being in the room would really help. So I would just sit in the room trying to look cute, and and then I would have to get a call later that day. Oh, NBC pass. Oh, ABC pass. And I was like, because I said to them, I experienced enough rejection. Yeah. I don't need it about something that I'm not even writing.
Yeah. And ultimately really stops being about you.
Yeah.
At a certain point. I mean, that was, they wouldn't let me in the room because I talked too much. And
right.
I think they were afraid that I would basically hijack it. And right. then they'd be like, wait, who's writing this thing? Like, I don't get it. So I don't know. I feel like maybe had I been in the room, we could have done a better job. But
right,
you know,
right. I know.
But it, you know. At the end of the day, it was, we got a little too close to the sun. It was like, it was one of those things where you were like, I mean, I've worked in entertainment, in development, and so it's not like I didn't have a realistic view of like the chances of it happening. Like I understood it was a lottery prize, but as you get closer, you begin to realize like you're holding the golden ticket, you know? And so that lottery starts to feel less and less
within reach.
Yeah, it does. So it was definitely, thankfully I was pregnant, and literally the day we found out that Showtime passed was the day I found out I was having a little girl, and I like could have cared less. Like I was like, whatever, I'm having a little girl. So it really wasn't until after she was born that I think then I had to mourn the loss of the project, because all of a sudden I was like, oh shit, now what am I doing?
Well, which is also fun with, you know, postpartum hormones probably.
Oh yeah, it was a good time. Yeah.
I forgot to set the second recorder because I just do it because I'm super paranoid that things aren't working, but things are totally working.
Okay, good.
But, you know, in terms of the lottery ticket, you know, you'd already sold the book. Like, that feels like the lottery ticket. Okay, wait, let's take it back. Yeah. Because, so you worked for Regan Books, and you were living in New York.
Yeah, briefly. I had actually, when I will get into the getting sober part.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah,
I'm totally distracting about that.
You took it there. I had been living in LA for a couple of years, and my uncles kind of intervened and said, hey, I don't think this is a party anymore. I think this is a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And why don't you come and live with one of us? And so I had the choice between my gay uncle in Florida and my Republican uncle in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
But since I'm from Dallas, I was like, I'll go to
the
Dallas.
Republican, yeah.
Yeah, because I felt like that's probably safer than Fort Lauderdale.
Yeah.
Where I actually have done a significant – I mean, I've done a significant amount of partying in both cities, but I at least had like more of a network in Dallas. So I moved there. And I got sober for the first time. I ended up working as a secretary at Mary Kay Cosmetics.
Shut up.
A department where, to this day, I still don't know what they did. All I know is they scheduled meetings about having meetings. That's all I know. And like my job every day was to update the org chart. Like but I had to wear pantyhose.
Oh my God.
And it was actually during a period where my car had gotten in a wreck and I was driving it was with an old lady. And so I was driving like this weird leased like Mercury Sable from like 1998. And wearing pantyhose and
amazing.
Going into the office at Mary Kay and like chain smoking cigarettes on my break, like feeling like I was trapped in a bad early 80s sitcom. Like,
well, that and that you were 57 years old, probably.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Like, that doesn't sound like, you know.
No, I mean, a year prior, I had been like at the Beverly Hills Hotel and was like taking meetings with directors.
Right.
And like, had like a big producer boyfriend. And I was like, what the fuck happened?
Yeah.
And I had an opportunity in the midst of that amazing job to go and work for Judith Regan in New York. I literally took the interview in the stairwell of Mary Kay Cosmetics, like with my pantyhose on, talked to Judith Regan, and I was like, anything to get out of a pair of pantyhose.
Yeah.
And 2 days later, I was on a plane in New York.
Wow.
And that's how I ended up in New York with Regan.
Yeah.
Very tentatively sober at that point, because then all I did was work. So
yeah.
I didn't do the things that you need to do to stay sober, because
right.
I lived and breathed Judith Regan for 6 months.
Right. And you didn't have time to drink. Really?
Yeah, you didn't have time. Well, she hated alcoholics, so I could not tell her that I was an alcoholic. She didn't drink either, so mm-hmm. we just kind of bonded over that neither of us drank.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she was way more into, like, rage.
keep in mind that I'm obsessed with this, whatever. Yeah.
You're obsessed with a Judith?
Well, only because it was my dream to sell a book to her, and I did. You know?
And I was there when
you sold
that book. I know,
that's so weird. So wait, what happened? So you weren't in the meetings.
I was in one meeting with you on the phone. The weirdest thing, it was a meeting when we had moved. So we moved the offices out to L.A.
Yes.
Regan came out to L.A., and that was the other part of me taking the job, in addition to it being my dream job as well, because I had worked in book publishing when I was first out of college. That's what I did. I worked at St. Martin's, and then I worked at Simon & Schuster in editorial for a couple of years before 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came out to L.A. as just sort of a post 9/11 drug-induced meltdown. And so I love books. I love book publishing. I'd gladly go back if there was an industry here outside of our mutual friend, Dan Smetenka, who's like the only one.
And also you'd go back if you could probably make more than $19,000 a year.
Oh, totally. Totally. Yeah. No, I mean, I don't know. I'd probably still make, I was always willing to give up a paycheck for that kind of job.
Really?
I still do. I work in nonprofit, you know, when I'm not writing for recovery websites. So I've never really, I guess I should go to DA for under-earning. But the
Well, I will say, we at After Party can't afford you. That's the truth. So are you an under-earner? Because, like, I wouldn't even insult you with, like,
I know.
Our money.
Well, you know.
Or maybe I did, and that's how
know.
I found out.
I actually went to you and was like, all right. And you were like, I won't even insult you. I'm like, insult me. I mean, I do
really?
far lesser things.
No, but I just – well, I screwed myself because I hired you at The Fix.
Yeah.
And I had come up with what The Fix was going to pay.
That's awesome. We love you for that.
I know.
They still pay that.
It's crazy. They don't need to. But I didn't know. And so then when I started After Party, I realized that The Fix had gone under, and that one of the reasons it had gone under, and now it's, you know, obviously revived and better, was that we were bleeding money.
Yeah.
And
paying writers all this money that they still pay. That's still
I know. And so, I mean, I'd be happy to insult you and bring you into this fold, but you know, I'm realistic. And one of my writers, Tracy Jabalit, loves you, and we're always somehow talking about you.
I love Tracy.
Yeah,
she's amazing, and I'm so excited. She's got a writing career now. It's funny, you know,
in a minute.
I know. It's crazy.
I feel a little like I discovered her.
That's awesome.
Oh, that's how I sort of felt about you, because like you hadn't been doing online writing.
You taught me how to actually write journalistic pieces. Like you were literally my teacher. I had no idea how to. I had never done that before. I'd only written in first person. So
Oh yeah.
I mean, one day when I have like my booming New York Times career, I'll be like, Anna David taught me everything I know.
When you accept the award at the National Journalism thing that I don't even know exists.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you. Don't forget.
Yeah.
So you take your drinking and drugging career from Dallas to from LA to Dallas to New York to LA?
Yeah, I did a triangle
basically
with my life. Yeah, so I just kept going. Like started in Dallas, went to New York, ended up in LA, went back to Dallas, went back to New York, ended up in LA, and really haven't moved since.
Okay.
Outside of that 1 year in Paris, that you know.
The year in Paris. I forgot about that. Oh, that's right. Okay.
So I ended up with Judith, and we did have a conference call in L.A., and you were on – you must have been in New York, or you weren't in L.A.? I don't know.
I definitely –
I just remember you being on the speaker in the middle of the desk.
Me, because – yeah, who I loved Maureen. I loved my editor. Yeah. I loved that it looked like I was going to have a career like the one in that Renee Zellweger in Ewan McGregor career where you never saw that movie Down with Love, where like it's what like being a book author is supposed to be like, and like her life is fabulous. And she hangs out with her editor, and they all go for drinks, and everything's perfect. But it would have been the sober version, and that's how I felt back then.
I thought that I was going to have that too.
I know.
Well, and Des, you do have those moments though. I mean, everybody does. You have that, like, I mean, I was thinking about this morning, you know, like you go and you speak at Barnes & Noble or Book Soup, and like you go out and you have the party afterwards, and everybody's like, sign this book, and you're like, oh my God, I've made it. And then like you know, the rest of...
Then there's the rest of your life.
Yeah, then there's the rest of your life. So not like that.
But okay, so yes and no. So, I know, it's true. But also you start to realize, like, I truly believed, and I was talking about, have you read, do you know Blackout, that new book by Sarah Heppala?
Yes.
She was on the podcast last week.
Oh, nice. I'm in good company.
I know. She's amazing.
Yeah.
We were talking about just like how it never makes you happy.
Yeah.
She's had the kind of success like
that we all dream
wanted,
of. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And the truth is, and she's totally grateful. It's not that, but it's just none of it actually gives you the happiness that you pretend it will.
Yeah.
You know?
It doesn't.
Well, it doesn't. It doesn't. You know, I mean, it's like
I think it's fleeting, though.
Yeah.
You know, I think that, yeah, I think it's happy in moments, but like no matter what, you still
have life.
Have life. Yeah. I mean, I know there was a moment where like when we were, and I'm sure you had this too, like when I was in a meeting for the book to become a TV show, and we were meeting with these two writers who ended up not being on the project, but they loved the book, and they're like pitching me my life.
Yes.
And like, you know, my ego is just probably bigger than that room.
Right.
And I was like as high as a kite.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I literally, it was like I had done a mound of cocaine.
Right.
I was so, you know, freaking stoked. And I left and I was like, you know what? No matter what happens, I've got to have that moment. And that's it. Who the hell gets to have that moment in life? You know, like,
right.
I mean, it's self-aggrandizing and, you know, and whatever, but it's also really exciting that like something you did has led to this place where other people want to like do it with you, you know? And that's really like, that's awesome, you know? And it was like, you got to like celebrate the little victories and just be like, like, because you know what? If you told 12-year-old me that shit was going to happen, you know, I would have like slobbered all over you. I don't know. I mean, that's just like...
Yes. And I think it is true. But it's sort of like if it's ephemeral or long term.
Yeah.
But nothing really works long term except the sort of spiritual life and the gratitude for, you know, what we have.
Totally.
So, okay. So taking it back. So you were a drinker and mostly a pot smoker, if I'm remembering. Or your dad was a pot dealer?
My dad was a pot smuggler.
Smuggler.
Yeah. Bring it up a notch, girl.
Well, you wrote about it for me. I still remember the photo of you two from the fix.
Sorry. That's right. Yeah. My dad was a kingpin. So when I was born was sort of the height of his career.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny. I was actually just like, my grandmother, my mom and grandmother lived in so much denial at the time that they really just still are sort of like, I don't know what he did. I'm like, with it.
Wow.
I mean, you know, and they're like, I don't think it was that big of a deal. I'm like, he was flying DC-10s of pot, and you know this. And they're like, was that a big deal?
Right.
And I'm like, really? Like, I think, you know, there's just
denial.
Sort of denial. Like, still. Like,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
40 years later.
Yeah.
Like, the man's dead.
Yeah.
You know, story's long gone and still denial. I think the other thing, too, is that they know for me, it was always, and still to this day, I mean, I'm sober in almost 9 years, and I still think it's cool. Like, I was just talking to people this weekend. Like, we were watching Narcos, and, like, one of the main characters in Narcos is Carlos Leder, who was, like, a big guy with Pablo Escobar. And my dad helped to bring down Carlos Leder. Like, he's in the book Blow. Like, the movie Blow is all about that, bringing down Carlos Leder. And, like, my dad didn't make it into the film, but he was in the book as, like, being key to that whole deal. And... you know, and I'm like, that's still like really freaking cool to me. Like,
I know.
You know, like, I mean, I certainly used as a reflection of how he used, like, whiskey, cocaine, and weed, you know.
But I mean, that had nothing to do with him being sort of this badass criminal. That was just your genetic predisposition. Or you're saying, right? Or are you saying using with him, like him?
I feel I was genetically predisposed.
Yes.
I mean, I have alcoholism on a couple different lines of my family. So I think that I was pretty set up. I mean, I feel like I was exhibiting traits by age 3. It's interesting. Then you have a baby and you always wonder, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I just feel like she has such a solid nervous system. Like, I feel like my nervous system was disorganized from the get-go. And I mean, like, how could it not be? Like, I was also born into a house where, like, you know, we lived on the lam. Like, nobody could know who we were. Like, there was massive drug deals going all around. And my dad was doing cocaine in, like, the basement with his boys while my mother, like, ironed sheets upstairs trying to pretend life was normal. Like, I probably was pretty fucked up, like, out of the gate, you know?
Right.
Like, as much as my mom tried her best to create like a false normality. Like there wasn't, you know.
Do you have siblings?
No, I'm an only child.
So. And when you say on the lam, like what do you literally mean? You guys were, you know.
Oh, we'd get up and go in the middle of the night.
Like Running on Empty, but about drugs. Did you ever see that movie?
No.
Seminal movie of my childhood for some reason. Yeah. River Phoenix and his parents are, they're activists. Yep. And, okay. They killed somebody in a bombing.
Yeah.
And so they just are always on the run.
Yeah. Yeah, that was, I mean, we would have a house for about 6 months and then we would get up and leave it. Like, even if we owned it, it was very confusing. And then we'd end up somewhere else for, you know, anywhere for 3 to 6 months. And then, I mean, we lived in like Easton, Connecticut. Like we moved to the East Hamptons. We were on a compound actually with, Jan Wenner and, Ralph Lauren.
So kind of baller places.
We were baller. Yeah. Yeah, my dad
paid cash.
Yeah, paid cash, yeah. My dad ran Jamaica. Like, that was his country. He paid off the prime minister.
Wow.
And he was the sole exporter of marijuana out of Jamaica. So, like, if the Colombians wanted to bring in some Jamaican weed, they'd have to go through my dad to broker the deal, in addition to my dad just doing his own exporting. But, I mean, he was also, like, the biggest drug bust in Jamaica still to this day was a plane of my dad's that, like, they didn't lay enough runway strip for, and the stupid plane crashed because of the morons on the ground that was, like, my dad's crew. Like,
right.
They were a little bit, like,
high.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, basically. They were a little bit high.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was like a bunch of stoners
trying
to run like a multi-million dollar business. And
right.
Like, and just consistently screwing it up. And like, you know, so my dad was busted in 82 and was sentenced to 66 years, no parole. And then he actually broke out of prison after about a year and a half and was on the lam for a year and a half.
Shut up. Okay.
My dad was like, you know, I mean, as I wrote in the book, like, honestly, you can't have a more like romantic outlaw archetype than I did with my dad.
Right.
Like the fact that I'm with somebody who like all he wants to do is stay is like just a near miracle.
Right.
Like, my husband might have his faults, but like he's so the antithesis of that. He's like, no, let's just be together forever.
Right. Right.
Like my dad was like, I will, you know, run off into the sunset and good luck trying to catch me, you know.
So
then he got back. After that year and a half on the lam, he met up with George Young, who's the Johnny Depp plays.
Yeah,
Blow.
Yeah, the Blow.
Yeah, and he met up with George Young. He helped bring down Carlos later. They halved the sentence down to 33 years, no parole, of which he ended up serving about 25.
Did he die in prison?
No, he was out. So he really was released in 2003. Sort of my bottom timed mm-hmm. out with his release. So he was released in 2003. I actually, the weekend that he was released, I was like, a friend of mine was like selling like 25 pounds of pot in LA. And like, I was with him that weekend. We were in like the Standard Hotel and it was like totally crazy. Me and my best friend were like those two girls that like were just like hanging out in the background.
Right,
like
right,
a Tarantino
right.
film.
Right, right.
Remember those chicks? And yes. We went to go get barbecue in the valley and like I get this phone call from my roommate that my dad's out, like randomly after like 24 years of waiting for the man. He just like one night gets out.
Oh,
and
my
is, like
God.
Free. But he went straight back into the business. A year later he was picked up, sentenced and put back in for about 6 months or a year. Happened a couple of times over the next few years, and finally in 2008, right as I was writing 5150, so I had no idea that in the middle of my writing this book that my dad was going to be released
right.
for sort of the final time. And he actually, in all those previous releases, we never saw each other. I had seen him in the holding center in Tallahassee. Actually spoke at his sentencing right before I got sober. I was like in a super alcoholic bottom. I ended up getting like trashed in Tallahassee and like meeting some like black dudes at a bar and trying to like buy pot off of them.
Oh my
and
God.
They like lived in the hood. I drove drunk to the hood to buy the pot off of them. And literally the guy gets in my car and I'm like, so are you guys partying? And he's like, no, we're not. Cause he was like, there's no freaking way this honky is coming into the party.
Right,
like cops are coming so fast if you let this crazy like white drunk bitch into this party.
Right.
He's like, no way. Well, he's like, here's your weed. Please go home. Be safe.
It's also funny because I guess I hadn't met you when I was editing you or whatever. I remember the first time I met you and I was like, oh my God, this little angelic blonde with the blue eyes and the innocent face. Like, I remember being surprised by that. So for them, they were just like, Jesus.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, they were like, they wanted nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the next day I went, and then, like, you know, of course I'm like, I'm here visiting my dad in, like, the detention center, like, thinking that's going to be street, badass, you know, street cred, you know, like, I'm literally wearing, like, J. Crew tweed ballet slippers and, like, a merino wool sweater with corduroy pants. They were pink.
Right.
I remember the outfit to the tee.
Yes.
And they were just like, what?
They probably thought you were lying.
Yeah, no, they had no idea what I did. I don't think they'd actually ever seen anything quite like me. So they were just terrified. I scared the living shit out of the gangbangers.
Right, more than they scared you.
Oh, yeah, no, they were just like, oh, my God, get away from this girl. So I got to see my dad that next morning. And then I don't think I saw him one other time. No, that's not true. I saw him one other time to make amends in a prison in Pennsylvania. And then he was released, and I got to have dinner with him one time in L.A. And that was the only time I had ever seen him free since I was 5 years old.
Wow.
And that was in the middle of 5150, and he actually became – so in 5150, I started doing non-date dates, like, pretty early on in the book. Like,
I don't remember the book as well as I should, by the way.
No, don't worry. I barely remember myself, but I just remembered this fact, actually. Right. I was like, oh, that's right. They weren't all but, like, random dudes.
Right, right.
So I – at some point, somebody asked me, like, what constitutes a date then? And I remembered saying, like, anything that brings me closer to love. So I started seeing, like, a shamanic therapist throughout the course of that year. So she became a reoccurring date. Like, I went on a date with my mom and a date with my grandma and a date with my uncle. And, like, and my dad shows up, like, at the end of the book. It was one of those, like, great, like life couldn't have written this better, you know?
Right.
And we went on a date in L.A., and he walked out the door, and I knew I'd probably never see him again. And about 4 months later, actually it was like 4 months, that was October, and 4 months later to the day he died of a heart attack in the midst of a drug deal in upstate New York.
And how old was he?
He was 63.
Right. Yeah. Long life for the life he was living.
Well, he was in prison for 25 years of that 63 years. So yeah, I mean, he went in when he was 32 or probably like 34 when he went in. And he wasn't released until he was about 60. So yeah.
And so you're using, that's what I was trying. So alcohol and pot were your main things.
And Coke. Oh yeah.
Cause potheads and Cokeheads don't usually combine in the same person.
They do in me.
Look at this anomaly sitting on the couch. You know what I mean though? Don't you find that rare?
Not really. Amongst my friends, but maybe I was friends with all the, like, stoner Cokeheads.
Yeah, maybe you found them.
I did.
We do find people like us wherever we go.
Yeah, no, I was both of those very strongly. I was a super stoner. They used to call me Princess Floyd after the Brad Pitt character in True Romance. Because, like, I was totally like, can you get me some cleaning
products? Yeah.
Yeah. So, but then at the same time, yeah. I mean, for a lot of people who get sober young, right? Like, it's the drugs that bring you into sobriety a lot faster.
We could,
if we were like those people that just drink, I'd probably still be drinking.
Right.
You know, I'd be like one of those women at the end of the bar that's like overly tan with a craggly voice and like.
Right. And chain smoking.
Like super bleached blonde hair and like, hey, honey.
Yeah. What are you doing and the tonight? Sunburned cleavage. Yeah.
Totally. But the cocaine was the
e-ticket, as they say.
Yes.
The e-ticket.
Totally the e-ticket.
What made you, like, get sober in the end?
A relationship.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. You know, I think it was a lot of, you know, like all the stars line up, right? Like, it just wasn't working.
Mm-hmm.
And then I ended up dating somebody who I thought was like, I found him. And he's it's 5150. He's a major character in 5150 because I was still obsessed with him at the time of writing the book.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually was a date in the book where we finally got to, like, make it right. But he totally thought he had found her. And then he discovered her had a very
kind of severe cocaine addiction problem. And he liked to party, mm-hmm. but like he was, you know, he was a norm. He was a borderline normie.
Right.
You know,
right.
I had clearly crossed the line. Mm-hmm. He was sort of straddling the line mm-hmm. and being with me only made him feel like he was really over the line.
Right.
So he put an end to it. And my friends were so tired of hearing me talk about him that, of course, I went to a therapist because they can't tell you not to talk about him because you pay them.
Exactly. They'll listen forever.
Totally mental prostitutes.
Yeah.
It's like, here's my $100, lady. Shut up and listen.
I know. If only sponsors and friends could do that. I know.
And she was awesome. I remember it was at Cedars-Sinai, and I'd always be in the elevator with like the pharmaceutical saleswomen that mm-hmm. were like so like their
together,
hair was blown
yeah,
out.
And the heels.
And that yeah, and they had like keyless ignitions and shit like that. Mm-hmm. And I'd be like, I'm so fucked up. Mm-hmm. And on my first visit, she said I could come back, but only if I went to three meetings, AA, NA, and CA that week. She wanted me to check out all three of them. And because I just wanted to talk about him, I was willing.
What a great therapist.
She was amazing.
On session one, she
on
said
session
that?
Session one.
And also, kudos to you for being honest enough to tell her whatever you told her that
well,
made her say that.
The craziest thing was is that I had been going to therapy for 10 years saying I never was like quiet about like
right.
I didn't know it was a problem.
Right.
I think I was more bragging.
Yeah.
Like I'd be like I would go to a therapist and be like, man, like I just did an eight ball last night.
Right.
And like they never said maybe you have a problem. They just like I had one in New York that literally just pet her dog the whole time. And like my poor mother paid so much to all these therapists that like never did anything but just like pet their dogs.
Yeah, and I never had a therapist say a goddamn word to me about
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Ever. And
ever.
then I hear stories like yours and I wonder what was wrong with them.
Yeah. I just don't think – I don't know if they don't pick – I don't know. They don't teach it? Do they not know?
I think now it's different.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe in the 90s they were still – in the early aughts.
They were still hungover from the 80s yes. and they were like, well, I'm doing blow in the closet.
Yeah,
so
totally.
What's wrong with
what's
that?
What's wrong with that? So yeah, Bernadette. I remember that was her name.
Wait a minute. Does she work in recovery still? No, different Bernadette.
I don't know. Is there a Bernadette who works in recovery? Could it be the same woman?
Yeah, we'll talk off air.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Could be.
I mean,
is she sober?
I don't know. I never found
okay.
out. And I actually was once in Cedars for something else and I tried to go to her office, but you have to like buzz in for an appointment. No one's, you know, there's no receptionist because I wanted to say thank you because
right.
she literally got me going to meetings and I, you know, I wasn't done yet. I basically would go to this Friday night CA meeting mm-hmm. and then on the way home, I would stop at Trader Joe's and get two bottles of Two Buck Chuck.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I'm managing and controlling
mm-hmm.
people. It's
mm-hmm.
all totally fine.
Mm-hmm.
And then the uncle came to town and mm-hmm. then it was clearly not fine. And I think, you know, they had both, you know, they'd had their fun days and, you know, my family was always like, we drink and dance and have a good time together. So I think that for me, knowing that they weren't coming from a judgy place and knowing that they came from a place where they, you know, might not have been exactly there, but, you know, had certainly, I mean, my gay uncle probably like, right. He had the lifestyle. But,
yeah.
They were at least... They came at it in just the right way. And I was already going to meetings, so I knew, mm-hmm. you know, I knew. And it just felt like, you know, if any, also, you know, quit your job, come home and live for free
mm-hmm.
always sounds like a good idea when you're not in a good place.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah.
At least, I mean, I was going to live with my uncle, which is kind of fun. So it wasn't even like a terrifying home. It was
mm-hmm.
like a, you
mm-hmm.
know, a safe place that had a pool. And I was
yeah,
like, sweet.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, yeah.
And a jacuzzi. And I was like, I'm in, hot tubbing. No
yeah,
job.
My family tried that one on me too, but I didn't have a job. So I guess that it was like they were already like I was taking money from them
yeah.
anyway to live in my own place.
Yeah.
They,
so you were like, I don't need that. I can just
yeah.
sit here by myself and not have you watching me.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, and when I was ready to go to treatment, I was ready to go to treatment. They
yeah.
were like, I did the intervention and then told them, basically, you know.
You're like, so I've intervened on myself.
Well, my parents are crazy. I feel like I've talked about this on the podcast before, but I called and told my mom I had a coke problem, and she's like, great, come home, we'll discuss. And then she went and called a cult deprogrammer, because it was Marin County,
yeah.
and named Dr. Randy Rand, and they had me meet with him. And I was like, first of all, I'm not in a cult, I'm just a coke addict, and second of all, I've been deprogrammed. I want to go to treatment.
Yeah, you're like, no, I actually want to get into a cult.
Like, no, exactly. Exactly.
Like I need a group
deprogram-
of people to brainwash me. I don't need
deprogram me so that I can get deprogrammed
yeah.
against cults.
Yeah.
So, okay. And so, and then
after, so it took a few tries and then you did it.
Yeah, I moved to Dallas basically. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, I literally the night I drove into Dallas, one of my party friends drove with me and we went to a bar and I drank everything that I would ever want to drink for the last time. And I woke up the next day and decided to be sober. And I went, and then I was sober for the next year and a half until I quit Judith Regan.
Okay.
And then, and so we ended up back out here and, you know, Judith hated alcoholics, so that was nothing I could ever share. So I couldn't be like, I need to go to a meeting. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those jobs. I mean, it was, Devil Wears Prada actually came out during the time of that job. And she told me to go see the movie so I could see what a good boss looks like. And then she proceeded to BlackBerry me the entire movie that I couldn't even watch it. And then at the end, I was like, actually, I would so much prefer to work for Anna Wintour or Meryl Streep as Anna Wintour, because she didn't scream. And God love Judith Regan. I know she's got a publishing house running again. And
she does, right?
Yes, yeah, she does. Actually, Maureen is working for it.
Maureen!
Yeah. Oh my God. I'm stoked. I mean, that was actually the one person that Judith was always really good to was Maureen.
Oh my God, awesome, that's amazing. Yeah. That makes me want to write books again.
I know. I was like, Judy. But I basically lived with her. Like, we became super close. Like, our joke was that everybody thought we were a lesbian couple. We moved out to LA. We were staying in the Sunset Tower Hotel in a suite together.
Not bad.
Yeah. And no, it was. It was the life. I mean, I like got to hang out with the Beastie Boys during that job. Right. Like, I, you know, like, Ad Rock like helped me clean up a party, and
wow
and Mike D's wife was mean to me, and I, you know, it was like totally like dream job, except for on the other side of that, you know, there were days where I knew I was going to get yelled at for something and my grandmother would have to remind me, you know, just remember, Kristen, she can't shoot you. And I'd be like, actually, that's debatable. So there
Yeah, it's interesting. I worked for an extremely abusive boss at the Fix, and yes, it was
similar personality. Yes.
Oh my God. Yeah. It was, you know, and I was writing Tom Sizemore's book at the same time.
So you were getting it on both sides.
Well, and him saying to me like, fuck you, you dumb cunt, you're stupider than I thought you were, was better than what I was getting from my day job. And yeah, it's a torment. Yeah. You know.
No, it is. It's a crazy kind of hell,
yeah,
to work in a job like that. And so the day I quit, while sitting in her bedroom at the Sunset Tower Hotel, which was like a great moment for me, framed with LA in the background.
Oh, right.
I was like, if only there was a camera on me right now. That night I took like a bar of Xanax and that was pretty much it. And I was out.
Wow. Okay.
And so then, but I was out for a whopping 3 weeks. And in that time I very quickly discovered that even, head full of book, yeah, full of booze.
Yeah.
It did not work.
Yeah.
And I was just straight back into it. And the scariest part is, at least for me in terms of relapsing, is that my tolerance was as low as it had ever been, but my craving was as high as it had ever been. So I had never before been scared of overdosing. Like, that was just never in my even
with
conscious.
Coke?
Yeah, with Coke. Like, I was just like, who does that, right? Like, that's like for like Bret Easton Ellis movies. Like,
right.
That just doesn't happen.
Right.
You know? And during that 3 weeks, like, I probably was lucky to make it out alive, because it was just crazy how sick I was getting from stuff.
Really?
Yeah.
Were you using alone?
No, I went straight. I had party friends here. Mm-hmm. So I just, there's a gay couple who, thank God for them. You know, like, I don't have rape or like gnarly stories like that, yep, in my story, because I always had effeminate bodyguards, as one man called them. And those effeminate bodyguards kept my shit in check. And they like, they would lure me with baggies. You know,
yeah,
they'd be like, oh, you want to leave the party and go to him? But look what we've got. Tick, tick, tick.
Oh,
tick.
So they would consciously.
Yeah, they would totally. They would always bring me home with them and not let me go with randoms, you know?
Yeah, I had like a very similar experience, but I had stopped going to parties, but I only used with gays and alone my last, yeah, 3 years.
Yeah. So that's, yeah, at the end I was just, I actually would drink at the Normandy Room, which is a lesbian bar that's no longer there now in West Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like a Butch Dyke lesbian. I was, right, the token straight girl.
Right.
And then I would drink at La Barcito, which is also no longer there, which was like a tranny gay bar over in Silver Lake. Mm-hmm. That literally, there's like a stage, and it was awesome because it'd be me and like three, like, this is when they called meth Tina.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it would be like three trannies on Tina and me like dancing on the stage while my like, amazing, gay friends played pool. And that was my bottom.
So your using was fun. Even your bottom?
Even my butt, yeah, it was, I guess. I mean, it was, you know, the thing was, though, it wasn't until, like, I was left alone at the end of the night. Like, yeah. I was with a couple. So that couple would go off and go to bed.
Yeah.
And it would be me and whatever was left on that plate.
Right.
And the birds would be chirping.
Right,
and I'd
be
smoking those cigarettes that, like, only had, like, you know, half an inch on them in the, you know, in
like
the ashtray.
Yeah, you would take the butts out.
I'd take the butts out and relight.
Yeah.
You know, and, like, and find whatever swill, you know, looking in the empty beer cans from the party that had been there for, you know, something that looked left and that there wasn't a cigarette butt in.
Yeah.
And I couldn't go to bed.
Yeah.
You know, no matter what I did. And I just fucking hated myself.
Right.
And so, like, yeah, 6 hours prior to that moment might have been fun, but I kept hitting those mornings. And I did have a job. So what was worse was my alarm would go off while I'm in that living room hunting for a half an inch of a butt.
God.
And I would have to get in the shower, hopefully find something to drink, you know, like a couple of shots of vodka to steady myself, and then drive to Beverly Hills to my job at a development company for a production company.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then go into that office and pretend I wasn't dying, you know?
Yeah.
And, like, and I would also get, like funky jaw from Coco, where you're like, you get shifty jaw. And so I, like, talk like that. I can't really, like, hold my shit. And I'd be, like, at the professional office, like, with my jaw shifting around, like, incapable of speech. And people would be like, what? Like,
but yeah, you know. And so, by the way, I did want to clarify, I was employed at the end. I had the 3 years where I wasn't.
Yeah.
But no, I had those nights too, when you're driving to work and you have not gone to sleep.
Sleeping,
and you're chain smoking and you're like,
And you're like, I got to pretend I'm normal now.
I would act crazy. I cried all the time, those, like, over nothing, like all day, and acted normal. Did you ever do coke at work?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that only made you worse. Like, for me, I was not good with just cocaine. Like, I needed coke and alcohol, you know? It was like, that was my lubricant, you know, otherwise it was just like nails on a chalkboard. So it would just make it worse, because then I would get even more like whack jaw, like my jaw would be all over the place. And then I'd be crawling, you know, then I'd be paranoid that, like, everybody knew. And the thing was, is that, like, that would be, you know, maybe like once or twice every 2 weeks, right? Like, it wasn't every day. So then all the other days I would come in, I'd be like normal Kristen, like the person you see before you now. So I think if I had been, like, insane or, like, fucked up all the time, it would almost, like,
they'd be like, that's her personality.
That's me.
Yeah.
But, like, but then I would be, like, articulate and, like, pitching things in meetings and, like, the go-getter girl that was going to, like, climb the, like, you know, the ladder of Hollywood. And then, like, I would come in and be, you know, basically mentally handicapped. And they'd be like, what? I don't know. Like, what could possibly be wrong?
Right.
And I don't think they even realize, like, as I later found out from a boss, like, he just didn't, he was like, I didn't think there was a problem. I just thought you worked in Hollywood and you were in your 20s.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, is I don't think, you know, crazy behavior is such an anomaly.
Yeah, totally.
Do you know what I mean? I used to, I had a writing partner who, I would always do coke before he came over, a gay. And I remember talking to him later and being like, did you know that I was wired? And he goes, no, I just always thought you were really sad.
Aww.
He's like, that's really the only way I thought you were altered. It's just, like, really sad during those writing sessions. I know.
That's
but that's how cocaine made me the last few years, you know? Those bird chirping days are sad.
They are. They're horrible. And you begin to, you know, and that's where I don't know. Had I not got sober, I really don't think I'd be alive. Only because I don't think I would have handled it much longer. And I was taking so many pills to try to get to bed.
Right. And that's the thing you'll overdose
on. Yeah, you're going to Heath Ledger at a certain point.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean,
basically, you're going to just take the wrong cocktail on the wrong morning, desperately trying to get to sleep and not hearing that voice in your head telling you what a fucking asshole you are.
Right.
And you're not going to wake up.
Right.
And it's going to be slightly on purpose because you're tired of that too.
Oh yeah.
You know? And
I
knew that that was in my future, and it felt like it was approaching even more quickly than I had anticipated.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I, so that's what motivated it. And on the second round, it only took me 3 weeks to see, like, oh shit, like, I very well won't make it out of this alive.
Yeah.
And I thankfully had an amazing sponsor who told me that, you know, recovery did not shut down in my absence,
mm-hmm.
and that no one would give a shit. So, and actually I just moved back to LA, so no one even knew me.
Right.
So
right.
they really wouldn't give a shit.
Yeah.
Because they wouldn't even be like, oh my God, she had 18 months.
As if anybody would do that
ever,
anyway.
But, you know.
I've never done that in my life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny because sponsees will talk about that. And I'm like, I've never heard anyone gossip. I've heard them gossip about everything else.
But yeah.
not, I can't believe that person relapsed.
No.
Ever.
No, no.
So then that's when it all started.
Yeah, that's when I got today sober.
Yeah, yeah, and that was 9 years ago, or is that?
9 years ago, yeah. I'll be October 7th, I'm 9 years sober. So
nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
And I am... And yeah, and that was, you know, that was the end. I mean, I remember again, it was sort of the same thing. I sort of knew it was happening, and I drank a Sparks. I'd actually been drinking all day, but it was down in San Diego, and I ended up like drinking a Sparks, smoking a joint, reading an OK magazine, and going to bed. That was like the end.
What's a Sparks?
A Sparks? I don't even know that they sell them anymore. It was like an energy drink that was like, orange soda with malt liquor in it.
Ew.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I think those things became outlawed, energy drinks
did.
And alcohol.
Yeah.
Like together.
Did.
Who knows? Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. Gossip magazines were a huge part of my story. I would get high on Friday and Saturday nights. I would get Wired and read People in Us Weekly in the bathtub.
That's what I do now, except for without getting high. My husband's like, really, another Us Weekly? I'm like, I need to escape.
Yeah, I can't do it anymore. I mean, and I used to write for those magazines.
Yeah. Well, now, see, My bread and butter now is I actually work for a nonprofit, and I'm I write grants
mm-hmm.
for abused and neglected foster care youth.
Mm-hmm.
So as I say, like when I'm done doing that,
yeah, you need
I want to be
escape.
Removed
yeah.
as far away from reality as possible.
Yeah. yeah. Yeah.
So that's why I watch things like America's Next Top Model and I read Us Weekly. And-
yeah. I mean, my thing is selfish. It's not some intellectual, you know, development on my part. It's just that it started to make me feel bad about myself.
Yeah, I have that too sometimes.
You know.
Less so now, but yeah, I've been through phases where I couldn't. Yeah, because I mean, on any given day, I still think I'm supposed to be rich and famous.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, it was also more slightly the inverse of that, of just like the tear them down part of the gossip stuff. It just made me feel like soul sick.
You had compassion for the stars?
No, I like, no, I mean, like, not really.
Is that just, because your ex-boyfriend is one? Is that it?
Yeah, no. No, it was, I remember the night I bottomed out on The Real Housewives.
Mm-hmm.
Where I just, the way they were treating each other made me soul sick. And
yeah.
I couldn't.
Okay,
well, and there
I
was the part
that
I was like, wait, I want a house in the Hamptons. And why do these awful people
have that? Yeah.
You know? Yeah. But so, okay. So, and your life now, besides that, you work for a nonprofit.
Mm-hmm.
You've ghostwritten a bunch of books, right?
Yeah. After 5150, I got into the business of ghostwriting. And I mean, you know, I continued to try to write the second book, which sadly just never would make it past draft one. I was going to do a book on my dad, actually. That
yeah.
did get you. You actually helped me get an agent.
I
too.
Did.
Yeah.
I vaguely remember.
And you're like my guardian angel of writing.
But what happened with that agent? Are you still with that agent?
He's no longer an agent.
Okay.
Yeah. Jason is he left.
That guy was so into being an agent.
He was. But
Jason
Ashlock,
right?
Yes. Yeah. But he does digital publishing now and he's really gotten into that.
Yeah.
He was already
yeah.
into that even when he was agenting.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm actually doing a book for somebody right now that he introduced me to. So I've stayed in touch with him throughout the years, even though he doesn't represent anymore. And I was, I actually had people interested in doing a documentary because I became good friends with a documentary filmmaker whose father was actually my father's lawyer. So we had this
wow,
relationship
yeah.
between our two dads, and it was kind of an opportunity for us to sort of do a work together.
Mm-hmm.
And he did an Oscar nominated documentary a few years back. And then he got on board a producer who had done Spellbound, that awesome
oh,
Spelling
I love
Bee doc.
That. Yeah, yeah.
So the three of us put together this whole pitch. It was like going out on my dad's life, and my aunt put the kibosh on it.
Oh, because she's in denial. No, she's not the one in denial about
she
it.
She is in denial about my dad. Yeah. Everybody, basically, all the women around my father are
wow.
in denial about my
yeah.
dad. But yeah, she was like, uh-uh. And to be honest, my father put her through so much hell. It felt like a really selfish thing. I mean, of course, I could have pushed forward with it.
Yeah.
But it was like, you know what? for my own personal gain, really, like, she's already been through enough because of my father's desire for his own personal gain, and I just didn't feel I needed to walk any
That's
in his
nice.
Footsteps.
That's honorable.
So
yeah.
We, yeah.
No, it is. I mean, you could have just
later
been
like, should I have done that?
Well, she's not going to see, you can just not see it. You know, but no.
Yeah,
I
but
get
it's
it.
His name. Yeah. And she, you know, she, I understood, and she's older, and it was like, you know what, it's okay. And we all sort of agreed that, you know, the director on the project, because of his own history with his own father, I think had compassion around that issue mm-hmm. too. And so we both sort of agreed to set it aside. And yeah, so I started ghostwriting and write, you know, 5150 is all about being single, and literally as it was about to be published, I ended up dating the man that became my husband.
Yeah.
Like the weekend I went out to do publicity for the book, I came back and moved in with him.
Right.
So it was kind of wild. Like the timing of 5150 like happened just as I was getting together with, and you know, my husband.
I do.
Him prior to even me dating him.
I did. Yeah.
So, so anyway, we began dating right around that time, and I started freelance writing, which was like a dream come true. And those years were awesome. And I got to go to like New York for a project. And I remember, and I had like, you know, crazy projects too that like fell flat on their face and totally, it was terrifying and I had no money. And, you know, like those things happen too. Because like you're just going from project to project with like nothing in between. And it was terrifying and exhilarating. And it involved me having to temp sometimes at corporate real estate companies and want to shoot myself. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like I just, it was awesome. And then I decided to go get a master's degree and do that in Paris, France, because isn't that a dream? And
yes. So, but then it wasn't.
It
didn't turn out to be dreamy.
No, because I hated Paris.
Yeah.
Terrible city.
Yeah.
It's an awesome city to visit. I mean, I can't wait to go back and visit.
Right.
And it's awesome in April. I mean, they wrote a song like April in Paris, because it's like April is the time to go.
Yeah.
It's
one month isn't enough to be great.
Yeah. One month is awesome.
Yeah.
A year. And some people love it and I get it, but it's just, I grew up consistently judged on how I looked, how I dressed, and whether I was cool enough mm-hmm. by a very judgmental grandmother who now lives in my backyard. But I
literally in your
literally
backyard.
In my, I like to pretend she lives in a tent, but there's a guest house in the back of our house.
You take care of her, kind of.
No, I was kind enough. Yes, I like to think of it that I was kind enough to let her move into my property. She does provide free childcare from time to time in turn, which is awesome.
Yeah.
And I, you know, but I don't know if she's happy with the deal. Mm-hmm. Some days she is. She loves the baby. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like your parents have their version of how you should live your life and you have your version on how you should live your life.
Right.
And I think for some of us, that struggle is a lot more clear or heightened. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was my whole life. Mm-hmm. I mean, since I was like a little kid, they had their Kristen, you know, cookie cutter mm-hmm. version of me, and I had me. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of my rebellion was, in fact, against that girl who was like, I mean, it was Little Flowers in the Attic, minus the incest,
right.
You know, but like,
right.
I grew up like the only child. My grandmother never had any other grandchildren. I lived in a room with my mom for the bulk of my childhood. The three of us lived together in a small condominium in Dallas.
Right. Like, wow.
I was dressed in bows and like, mm-hmm. I was always just, my grandma's very cool. Like she's still to this day, mm-hmm. like she like wears Vince mm-hmm. and you know.
Okay. So that's how she could be judgy about, which is what Paris kind of brought out was.
Well, Paris is basically filled with my grandmother.
Right.
Like my grandmother's always dreamt of going to Paris and she'd be perfect there. Cause she's one of those people that like on any given day, she walks out of the house and looks awesome. And like not in like a, she's like, looks like Hollywood, like cool. Like she wears like little white jeans rolled up and like the perfect little like, you know, like flared top with like awesome sandals that you're like, where the hell did you get those sandals? Like, how do you have those sandals? You know?
Wow.
And like, and she, you know, she wears like a little, like now she's into like her little straw fedora, which is, I'm kind of like, you're a little behind schedule on that, Nana, but it looks so
maybe
cute
it's
on
coming
her.
Back.
She's probably bringing it back.
Yeah.
Like she is a trend starter and she's always been that way. Like, you know,
right.
With her little like yellow, bright yellow Marc Jacobs purse, you know, and you're like,
Jesus, yeah, that's a lot.
And as a kid, I mean, we all kind of worshiped her. her. Like my uncles, my mom and I, like every, she was that way. Like in the 60s, she was the coolest mom on the block. You know?
Like
she wore pillbox hats before Jackie O did. And she had a Mustang convertible before anybody else did. And she was that woman in the 60s. And like, she's still that woman in the teens. Like at 83, she's like way cooler than I will ever be.
That's amazing.
And like, and she's still like, I mean, she basically has bought the entire outfit I'm wearing right now. In fact, thank you. Yeah, she bought it. Thanks.
Yeah.
So, so you know, when I went to Paris, it was basically like being surrounded by my grandmother.
So you felt, I mean, you were making that up a little bit, right? Like people weren't coming up to you and being like, why are you wearing that pink?
I was at Figaro Cafe, or how do you pronounce it, the other day, and I was chatting with a guy there who's from Paris, and he said, you know, the problem with Paris is that they just walk around looking you up and down all the time, like, what are you wearing? What are you wearing? What do you look like? And I was like, yeah, it's my fucking grandma.
That's
like,
amazing.
I'm not alone. The cute gay boy, gay Parisian boy, has the same experience. So,
well, so okay, so we have to wrap up. What should we say to wrap up? So you now have a 1 year old.
She's 6 months.
She's only 6 months.
Yeah.
Because I saw you like 3 months ago or something.
Yeah, and, totally. And yeah. She was a little 3 month little pup, and now she's a 6 month little pup. And you know, I mean, we talk about like, you know, I have to say it's probably the most enduring happiness I've ever experienced.
Yeah.
At first it wasn't. The first 3 months were sheer hell. And I was like, where's the joy in this?
Right.
I don't get it. Like, why the fuck did I just sign up for this lifelong commitment for something that is not that much fun?
Yeah.
Like, that was really dumb, particularly for someone who only likes to do things that are fun.
You know?
But then, like, you hit this mark and it totally changes. And, like, every day is like, you're like, this is enduring joy. Like, everything else might suck. Or not, you know, but like, my career box isn't checked right now, but, you know, but like, it's like, but I've got this babe. And so, and, you know, and we'll see, you know, she's the only thing that lately I'm like, you know, do I do a mommy blog? Is that what you do now? Like,
yeah,
you know,
do I? Something people do.
It is. Yeah. So, you know, I've bought the site.
Oh, you did?
I did.
Should you tell us the name?
Queenbabymamas.com.
Great.
Yeah.
Great. You
so
heard
the
it here first.
Queen Baby is off of King Baby. My husband actually came up with that one.
Yeah. 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 And the idea of alcoholics.
Yeah. So we're queen babies.
Yeah.
But then we're also baby mamas.
Yeah. Like it.
So, and it's basically for fucked up moms. Like, that's kind of like the idea that I wanted to do, was for women that, like, there's a lot of mom hating out in the mommy sphere, as I've discovered. Like, a lot of people, it's like, because forever you weren't like allowed to talk about like what a shitty job it was.
Yeah.
You know, you just had to pretend you loved it and how great your kids were and all that.
Yeah.
And now people are, you know, can say,
well, do you know Stephanie Wilder Taylor?
I don't.
Oh, she's amazing. Previous podcast guest.
Okay.
Baby on Board, B-O-R-E-D.
Okay, I'll check it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's her whole thing.
Yeah. So, and I know that's, you know, but I do think that women of a certain ilk who have their shit, you know, also come to the table with a whole lot of other stuff around parenthood. And I know, and also getting to do what you don't feel was done so great in your own life.
Right.
You know, I mean, I did choose you know, my husband, we split parent duties. He does half the week. I do the other half the week. And my grandmother's our pinch hitter in between.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, but like, we're co-parenting. And I think it's the girl, like, my family is all like the woman should be at home and the husband should work all the time. And like, they have a lot of issues around it. And I'm like, for me, I think it's the best scenario for a kid to grow up in. Like, I didn't have a dad at all.
Yeah.
And like, even, I'm sure you can attest, even people that did have a dad, they weren't present.
No.
You know,
yeah,
they were just
mine.
Sort of that like figure in the background that like came in as a guest star, you
to,
know?
Like, pay the bills. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, and she is really getting this like amazing, you know, my husband's got like his whole, my husband's very like surfer, skater, punk rock guy-ish, super sensitive version of all of that. And, you know, and he gets to like, you know, she was wearing, I don't know what band, some band, some punk band from the 80s, like LA punk band. Anyway, and he had her in like that onesie yesterday, and my grandmother had like a fit. And I'm like, that's awesome. Like, I dress her in a lot of pink, and like, you will see her today, and she's totally dressed like little girly style, you know? But like, I'm really grateful that she's also going to have days when she's out with dad and she's wearing her like punk rock onesie, you know? And she gets to have like that element in her life too. And we get to raise this baby with a whole other set of rules that is definitely informed by both of us being sober and in recovery and not like, you know, like my husband said today, like, hopefully we won't have a crazy teenager because we're going to support her in being herself. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't have a cookie cutter for her. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. like, I want her to create her own mold and, mm-hmm. like, support her in whatever that mold may be.
Mm-hmm.
And not have any expectations on her. And I think, like, because of that, like, going back to that piece of, like, the solid nervous system versus the, like, mm-hmm. completely disorganized one, like, she is so cool. Like, she's a little bit like my grandma. Like, she kind of, like, looks you up and down because mm-hmm. she's, like, you know, she's got her shit together.
Mm-hmm.
And we're still kind of the crazy people, so.
Well, lady, we got to wrap up. Yeah. I'm excited to go meet her, and thank you so
much. Oh, no, thank you.
So that was Kristen McGinnis, author of 5150, The Magical Adventures of a Single Life. And yes, I learned the entire name of the book in between recording this intro, the intro and this outro. Anyway, go get the book. Go check out more Kristen McGinnis. Go and keep listening to this podcast. And thank you. I've gotten some lovely emails of late, and I'm so grateful for every single one of them. So yeah, this was After Party Pod. See you next time.